Well, first, it's hard to compare with other, you know, I've only been in one or two other courtrooms in my life. None of them were like that, with the judge making so many objections to what could have been relevant answers, I thought, at any rate. They wouldn't have, you know, been startling, revealing statements that nobody knew anything at all about. I'm not privy to any secret information that could have been, you know, thrown out at the jury. But it seemed to me that some of the things Kunstler tried to get in did have some importance on the whole thing, and I was just...
Specifically?
Well, he wanted to bring out the blood in the halls of the Hilton, and the fact that there were bloodstains on the wing where I was, where it was impossible for anyone to have thrown anything on the street below. They would have had to go up over the building and down on the other side. He wanted to bring out the security at the convention itself, the three kinds, the regular amphitheater guards who are employed by a private company, the Andy Frame guards, the policemen who on occasions were outside of the blue curtain that surrounded the floor of the amphitheater, so they were out of sight of the TV cameras, and most of the delegates themselves, but were very much in evidence and uniformed in their boots and helmets and guns and looked very frightening. And a third kind of security people who, some of whom may have been plain clothes, Secret Service men rather, but a great many of whom apparently were from some private police organization, as well as the City of Chicago police, who were plainclothesmen, very clean-cut, crew-cutted young middle-aged men. And they were the most frightening because they would, you know, show up out of nowhere, so to speak. And I happened to meet the guy who was in charge of all these security details, and he pointed out to me who was and who wasn't. And it was frightening to see that you turn around, there was one of these guys sitting beside you or standing behind you or listening to your conversation a space or so away. And those are the kind of things Kunstler wanted to bring out. And I think they're important, you know, to the overall trial. And I was really, you know, everybody, I think, who reads the papers knows about Judge Hoffman and his objections, or his sustaining the prosecution's objections. But it's just, you know, you have to see it to really believe it. You don't believe it if you just read it in the papers.
And now one part of your testimony, or your intended testimony, that was ruled to be irrelevant and immaterial was the speech that you gave to demonstrators on the evening of the 28th in Grant Park in the presence of Dave Dellinger.
No, Tom Hayden.
Tom Hayden, that's right. Now that, of course, you were not permitted to summarize or repeat in the court, but maybe you would for us, as you can.
Right, I can remember some of the words exactly because it was very, very brief. I had been up to my room and had been to bed, had seen, you know, the violence and the people, you know, the blood on the walls, and gone to bed, and got up out of bed to come back down to the street, and just got up and said, in my first impulse, I had my back to the Michigan Avenue and the line of National Guardsmen there, I said, my first impulse, and pointed to the guardsmen, is to get the pigs. And the crowd, some of the crowd said, yay, yay, and some said, no, no, no. Then I said, but they don't have any responsibility for being where they are. They take orders from a higher power. Not a higher power. They take orders from a higher source. They themselves have no responsibility for being where they are. And that was exactly all of what I said, and then went. In fact, I came back a second time and spoke again very, very briefly and said almost the same thing, and then went back. And that was all there was to it.
Okay. Now, before I turn you over to Frank, who's our staff dialectician, I'd just like to ask you sort of a, you know, very general question about how you view this trial coming as it does at the end of this decade in which American politics have been, you know, rather radically transformed, and indicting or trying as it does the particular men it tries, whom you've known for some time. How would you simply describe the significance of this trial as a political event?
Well, I think it is, everyone says, it is a conspiracy, not on the part of the defendants, but on part of government officials, to select this group, the same as the Spock case, except it's turning out much differently and much better, I think, but to a conspiracy on the part of the government to select these eight men, to link them together in what the government says is a violent conspiracy, and to pin them down two ways, one by a terribly costly court procedure, to hang them up here in Chicago. What has it been, 2 months now, and will be maybe
almost
another
four.
Almost 4 months now, and will be some month or so to go. Spend vast sums of money for offices, bail, travel about the country, and so forth and so on. To tie them up in that sense, and if they go to jail, of course, to tie them up in that sense as well. So I think it's a serious attempt to do that. Then what it also does is has a deadening effect on other people like the defendants. So that if there is, say, a Tom Hayden at the University of Alabama who has the urge to go to Georgia to make a speech about student activism or on-campus politics, for that matter, he may feel the deadening effect of what happens here and may feel that the federal prosecutor in Georgia or Alabama will bring him to court under this law and tie him up in court procedure and send him to jail for years and years. And he may say that I'm not as well known as Tom Hayden is and I can't get a William Kunstler to defend me. And it just has a deadening effect on the whole movement, or rather it's intended to have that. I'm not really sure that it does. I think it has probably a heartening effect. The outcome may have a deadening effect. Say they are convicted here, they appeal, and the Supreme Court doesn't overturn the conviction. It may have a deadening effect, but I'd rather think it would have a heartening effect.
Could you elaborate on that a bit? I mean, what are your hopes or your expectations?
Well, my hope, of course, would be, although I don't wish them ill, I would like to see them convicted here and appeal to the Supreme Court and have the court say the law is no good, and so that people wouldn't have to worry about it for a short time at least, because I'm sure the government would come up with something else, but for a short time you wouldn't have to worry about it anymore. What also I'd like to see happen is, I don't know, I don't think the movement can develop an anti-conspiracy weapon, you know, unless it's a kind of weapon where everyone says, I am a conspirator. You know, everyone say who was in Grant Park at any time during the whole affair says, I was a conspirator, and if you were prosecuting them, you have to prosecute me as well. Well, I think that's about it.
Okay, there is one problem in, you know, putting or lodging any sort of hope, perhaps, in the Supreme Court's ultimately overturning the law on constitutional grounds. I mean, this, of course, is entirely a matter of speculation, but with regard to the whole court system itself, I know many of the defendants feel, or some of them do, that the whole episode with Bobby Seale perhaps revealed to a much deeper extent than anyone suspected the institutionalized forms of American racism. And of course, we recall that you made some statements with regard to the Seale affair at the time it took place. And I think it'd be appropriate if you, you know, could comment on that for us.
Oh yeah, I think if you, when you asked me what I wish would happen, I said that's a wish, that's what I hope would happen, is they'd get convicted here, because in the legal process it'd be important for them to get, you know, to get the law overturned would be important for a conviction to result and then the overturning of the law. But I think more and more, that's why I say it's difficult for the movement to have an anti-conspiracy weapon. You cannot really mount a legal weapon against it if you're faced with a judge like Judge Hoffman and a prosecutor like, I guess, the man has turned out to be, someone who, acting together, prosecutor and judge, just will not allow the facts to come out, you know, just will not allow the thing to be debated the way it supposedly is to be debated in a court of law. And then given the composition of the other courts that you're going to run into on the way up or below those, for that matter, you can't be really optimistic about any justice resulting from the thing eventually. That's why I think the anti-conspiracy weapon may have to be a massive conspiracy and a real conspiracy, you know, of a conscious and open conspiracy of thousands and thousands of people who will say as you try Dave Dullinger, you must try me too, or that I just won't even go to court. I just, you know, you'll have to come and get me, or people who put up physical resistance to it, violent or nonviolent, some kind of people who just say, no, I'm just not going to have anything to do with it, you know. And this is a good example of why I won't have anything to do with it. You can see there's no justice there. There's no, you know, no opportunity for any kind of argument at all. So it may come to the point when people just say, no, I'm just not going to have anything at all to do with it.
You think the Seale affair has really sharpened the political consciousness in the country at large?
I'm not so sure. I think it has among college students, but among people older than that, or people not in college of the same age, I'm not really sure. Now, during when that was going on, I was traveling around this section of the country, Midwest, and among college students, or people who I guess were, if you drew a line and they were on the left of the center, were outraged by it and thought it was what it was, you know, a deliberate attempt to, you know, first eliminate him, and a deliberate attempt to, you know, just completely squash and crush him and everything that he represents, which is black aggressiveness. But other people, I had the idea, didn't feel quite that way. On the one hand, they thought it was bad that anybody would be bound and gagged in court, but then they thought probably he shouldn't have behaved in that matter. Maybe he was a little disrespectful to the judge. So I'm not so sure if it had that kind of effect among people in general. I think it did among people who you generally call activists. I think it had a good effect on them in that it, you know, heightened their feelings or put feelings to them if they didn't have any about the courts and the way they are used and can be used and have been used. But I'm not, I don't think it had any kind of effect in the general population.
Okay, gentlemen.
Well, I only want to put some things that have already been said in a somewhat different context or press you a little bit on some of the things. The simply on the question of the judiciary itself and what's happened to it in the period of the last few years, from Abe Fortas in the Supreme Court to James Haggerty at stag parties at 3 o'clock in the morning in New Orleans, this is a sort of a two-part question. What's your assessment about the state, the credibility, the legitimacy of the judicial system itself at this point? And as a part of that, particularly related to the conspiracy case, doesn't it seem reasonable that even if there are convictions here, as is likely, that they may be reversed on the narrowest kinds of procedural grounds without the law itself being tested?
Oh, yeah, I can see that happening, particularly by the court as it is now or as it may be by the time this gets up to it, you know, or even as it would have been, say, 2 years ago, had the Supreme Court been the same as it was 2 years ago. But I think the sad thing that's happened is that people in the country as a whole don't have the same kind of cynicism and skepticism that they ought to have about the court system. And that is, assume they're convicted here, assume they go to the Supreme Court, assume the court reverses it on technical, narrow grounds. Large numbers of people say, I knew they could get justice if they just, you know, stuck with it long enough, and that proves that everything is all right. The number of people who will make the distinction between the technical reversal and the reversal that says that the law is bad and punitive and oppressive, I don't think people are going to make that distinction. They ought to make it, but I don't think they will make it.
Well, aren't they going to be forced to make it in the sense that what we're really talking about here and what this case represents, and you're uniquely qualified to talk about it as much a product of this last decade as any of the defendants, and having come at the end of an era, the government's faced with a problem. The irony, it seems to me, is that they passed a law which was originally provoked, for lack of a better word, by Rap Brown and Stokely Carmichael, and now they're applying it for the first time to whites. And there are two implications of that. One is that they've moved to a higher level with blacks. There, as I understand the debate in the Justice Department now, for example, it's as to whether to try Smith Act trials of the Black Panther Party. There's no consideration being given there of using this law against blacks. The irony is that this has now become a white man's law, and that, in fact, they now need this law because history has moved since the time of the Democratic Convention against the Weathermen, for example. What I'm trying to push for is, you know, your assessment of the dynamic. Where is it really going to go? What the government's options are increasingly limited, after all. They do need laws, in their opinion at any rate, to control a movement that's growing and that's acquiring momentum, not losing it. And what's your assessment of how they're going to do it?
Mine would be that their options are not that limited from their point of view, that although they do need laws, that is, on occasion, on most occasions, say, they need some legal justification for what they do, or some justification in law, need to be able to say, Joe Jones broke the law and we're prosecuting as we would anybody who did it, and there's nothing about his politics or his race or anything. Do you need that? I think that they are likely to become much more sophisticated in the sort of thing which happened to Black Panther Party leader Fred Hampton here, that sort of thing is what bothers me more than the use of the law as a justification. And I don't think you're going to see that kind of midnight raid. I think the Chicago police or police forces may have been surprised by the reaction to it. And doesn't mean that they're not going to be repressive and use violence and midnight raids and attacks, but I just think they'll get a little more clever with it. Now, how you can be more subtle than what they did there, I'm not sure, but I worry more about a violent response from those people in power than I do about their clever legal response or their legally justified response. That's what bothers me, and I don't know what form it would take, but it bothers me a great deal. One thing in the South now, you can see where in the early 60s there was a real, terrorism against black people was an everyday occurrence. It died down in 65, 66. The incident that happened was the exception rather than the rule. And now it appears beginning to happen again. You know, it's coming up again. And I think it may mean that perhaps the population itself will become violent. The part of the population that's considered reactionary will itself become violent. There won't be a need for policemen to come in at night, you know, with guns flying. But I have a very cloudy view of what might happen. But it's violence on their part that worries me more than their legal response.
Well, agreeing with that, isn't the problem in part that there has been, after every one of these, an initial wave of concern, not so much of anger, but of we deplore this sort of thing.
It should have been done, but not that way, you mean.
Right. It's the same thing that followed after all the assassination of Martin Luther King. It's the same thing that followed the assassination of Malcolm X. It's the same thing that followed the assassination of Fred Hampton, that the capacity of whites to deplore these things appears to be increasing. Their capacity to actually do anything about it doesn't seem to have changed much one way or the other.
Well, I think this is slightly different from the assassinations. What happened to Hampton is slightly different from the assassinations.
Mm-hmm.
And that although people are, suppose it happened tomorrow night in New York, the same thing exactly, there would still be a large hue and cry, and I think that would act as a prohibition against it being done again. I don't mean the police force would not be violent toward the Panthers,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think they'd be likely to stage another midnight or after midnight raid. They'd think of some other device employing violence and gunfire and so forth to do the same thing. They did it at night this time, I assume, because they expected an uprising to occur, and they picked a time when almost everybody's off the streets. But I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't try it. Suppose, say, Fred Hampton had been in Skokie speaking to a white audience and got him coming home in his car, you know, said he fired at a policeman and they chased him and gunned him down on a lonely street out there where nobody was around to see what happened. You know, no telltale bullet holes in doors or so forth. Nothing but a gun in his hand and bullet holes in his body. That's the kind of thing I would think might happen more often than the midnight raid, and people would not be able to deplore it because, you know, here the police would have much more credibility on their side in the eyes of the kinds of people who might just deplore and do nothing than they would in the usual midnight raid. That's the kind of thing that bothers me. And I think you're right about the shift in the movement from 68 to now. You know, it has changed very radically that... For one thing, Rapp and Stokely are silent, you know, and Rapp because of the courts used against him, and Stokely partly because of his fear of courts being used against him. Now, he is, as I understand, to come back to the country, and what will be done to or with him is something else, but it's that kind of, you know, unofficial terrorism. I think what happened to Hampton's case is official terrorism. It's going to be some kind of unofficial terrorism from the right that I worry about.
Which is, of course, a tradition of faced by the Southern movement, certainly in its early days, and as you say, again now. Let's push a little bit in a different direction, because that's a rather gloomy picture in a way, and I want to see how universally you feel about that. If this trial really does represent the end of an era of dissent or of protest, and it's been described in many ways, and if this is the beginning of a new decade, other than the intensification of struggle, which you've already spoken about in the black community and to some extent in the white, why not we'd appreciate your views whither in the 70s?
Okay, let me tell you about some bad things I think happened in the 70s. One bad thing I think is going to happen in the 70s is a large concentration among young people, who are the kinds of young people who, say, may have come to Chicago as McCarthy workers and come away as something quite different and much more radical. But I think they're going to be tricked into a number of avenues of protest, which, while extremely meaningful and worthwhile, are not going to really address themselves to the problem of people's condition. And that, I think, is a problem. You know, how much money does a guy have in his pocket? How does he control his job? Where does he live? What kind of education? Those are the real problems in this country. And, say, ecology, I think that is a dangerous, dangerous issue. Not because everybody shouldn't be concerned about air and water and the rape of the land and so forth, but I just see young people over the next 2 or 3 years particularly becoming so concerned about ecological problems and the very easy solutions to some of them. If a plant's polluting the water, picket it for a couple of days, get an injunction against it, you've won a victory and move on to something else. It'll be an exciting movement. It'll have some drama to it. You'll have an identifiable enemy, the evil polluter on Lake Michigan. And I just worry about that taking emphasis away from the other kinds of problems, which I think are much, much more pressing. Now, the argument, of course, is made if you don't take care of the ecology, then in 30 years there won't be any people to be discriminated against or to be the victims of racism. But as important as that is, I just think it's a dangerous thing to have people deeply involved in. It's going to take them away from other issues. In a way, the anti-war movement did the same thing. Now, that I thought was good. The anti-war movement took people's attention away from the South, for example. And I wish it had not done so, but I think the war was important enough to do that because there's a clear-cut connection, you know, between the war in Vietnam, what happens in the country. But this big push for ecology, particularly by liberal Democratic senators, and even President Nixon, Governor Reagan, bothers me a great deal. It's going to be the safe protest of the 70s, the beginning of the 70s anyway, and you're going to hear people talking less and less, I think, or you're going to have fewer people talking about more substantial issues.
War is still a substantial issue. What's your prognosis?
Well, that they're going to be, this is my prediction, is that they're going to be many more troops brought home over the next 2 years, and that by the 72 presidential elections, the number will be reduced by half, and that it'll never go below that number. That is, that President Nixon will be able to say, I have done in 4 years, I have reversed in 4 years a process that the Democrats took 8 years to build up. And this is what I've done. I've brought half of the boys home. And the others will remain there. They'll remain there. They'll be called advisors. They'll reinforce the South Vietnamese army. And unless the Chinese become more involved in it, which I doubt, things will be rather stalemated. Daily battles, five or six killed on the South Vietnamese side, and reports of hundreds killed on the side of the National Liberation Front. But I think the number is going to decrease, but only about by half, and that you'll still have this enormous number of American servicemen still there. But as the number decreases, so will the anti-war fervor, I think, unfortunately.
Isn't there still an international crisis that seems really to show no prospects of dissipating? For example, if not the Chinese, then there's every reason to think there'll be an intensification of activity from the Koreans, and incidentally, some have suggested that Elridge Cleaver may try to return to Oakland Bay and the Pueblo, and that's been the source of his subject of part of his conversation with Kim Il-sung. But that aside, the real question is that even with a reduced fighting force in Vietnam, there continue to be these international contradictions, which nobody really predicted would be as intense as they were in the 1960s. And there still then is this crisis around foreign policy.
Yeah, now, again, I'm not really able to see. I like to assume that Nixon, say, as a president now, is certainly not a stupid man and will be able to do some of the things he wants to do without appearing that he's doing them. Now, suppose insurgency breaks out in, any little South American country, let us say. And suppose it's a country in which the United States feels, from his point of view, that it has vital national interests and it's got to protect it. And in the past, the response, of course, would have been to land the Marines. I would think he would do the equivalent of landing the Marines, but how he'd do it, I don't know. But I think he'd do the same thing without involving the country in the same kind of emotional tie that it has to Vietnam, where there's so many Americans there. Now, how this be accomplished, again, I don't know, but it may be through the use of mercenaries, the way we've done in troops from Australia, from South Korea, and from the Philippines. It may be done through that way, so that it's not Americans who are there thousands of miles from home. And I just don't think he will want to involve American troops on foreign shores as much as other. He may want to, but I don't think he's going to do it. I think he'll accomplish the same end without doing the same thing.
We do have to ask one more question, obviously, at least, and that is, given the prospects of the nation and the globe for the 70s, what are the prospects for Julian Bond in the 70s?
Well, I really don't know. I'm not trying at all to be coy. I had thought about, you know, trying for a higher political office, and if successful in that, then for another. And, you know, it's very heady to have your name placed in nomination for one of the big political parties. And people write articles and speculate on television that you're going to be the first, or, as heard people say, the great white hope of the United States. But it's really not what I want to do. I have a lot of different interests. One of them is in the political process in the South. Now, I have not almost concluded that the political process as a national exercise is an exercise in futility. But as a local exercise with rather limited goals, it has a lot of hopefulness in it. Let us see what happened in Greene County in Alabama last year, where black people took over the government and certainly have not magically lifted themselves out of poverty simply by that device, but have, you know, taken a step toward controlling their own lives and improving their own lives. Is that's what I'd like to be involved in, is Southern local politics, is seeing black people begin to control some of the South, and beginning to do it in connection with some friends of mine who live in New Orleans who are trying to do the same thing among poor white people, and had a small success in a Mississippi town in building an interracial black and white political coalition built on economic issues, outgrowth of a strike at a woodworking plant. But that's what I hope will be my prospect for the 1970s.
Well, that was such a beautiful last question that I really hate to ask it, but I think to focus on sort of the purpose of what we're doing here. And a counterpart question is what role do you see in the 70s for men like Dellinger, Hayden, Davis, Abby, and Jerry?
Well, I think it's two things, and one probably they wouldn't like. The first one is that I think they state the issues. That is, they say this is the issue and not that. And because of their expertise and their experience in the movement, they generally state them better and draw the lines clearer than other people do it. The second role I think they have to play, and this is one I don't think they like, is they are agitators, and very necessary agitators. Now, some of them may not think of themselves as agitators, but I think they are, and I think they're very good agitators and necessary agitators. I am opposed to the movement concept that came to its height with Dr. King, of the fellow who comes in to a community, makes a speech, fires it up, and zips away. But I'm beginning to think that in some cases necessary. If Tom Hayden goes to Houston, Texas, then the left community there has, for an evening at least, a rallying point and may hear about activities in other parts of the country or theories that it's not been exposed to. And I think that's a very, very helpful role. And the third thing that all of them do is that they're thinkers, and they, you know, they think strategies. And I think that, you know, regardless of what happens here, that they'll be doing that for a long time to come.
You would finally really consider it sort of an inalienable constitutional right to travel in interstate commerce or use the facilities thereof with the intent to heighten people's political consciousness?
Not only that, but to preach overthrow of the government. I mean, that's an inalienable constitutional right. I almost got put out of the legislature yesterday because of that, but that's a right people have.
Okay, very good.